Okay, so it's good that I've been telling a joke at the beginning because I have now established a pattern of forgetting to tell another joke in the middle of the lecture. The rabbit gets onto the tram. Is this word tram familiar? Trolley car, tram. And he puts down his suitcase and he, reaches up and grabs onto the strap and, he's riding, it's the morning, he's riding to work, and then a few minutes later he looks down and his suitcase is gone and he gets furious. Briefcase is gone, he gets furious. He says, "Okay, that's it. I've had it. If whoever took my briefcase doesn't put it back right now, the same thing is going to happen as happened yesterday." And silence descends over the tram car, and there's nervous looking around, and finally the lion sort of reaches under his legs and pulls out the briefcase and sort of puts it down and says, "I'm sorry, I didn't. I don't know what but what happened yesterday?" And the rabbit said, "Yesterday they took my suitcase and they didn't give it back." Anyway. It's really quite a dumb joke, you have to admit. Quite dumb. Okay. So today, as you can tell, I'm a big one for reviewing everything that I did in the history of my life prior to starting a new thing. So let's just briefly say, for the sake of review, what happened last week. So in lecture one, we introduced the elements of differential geometry, and the idea was there was sort of, it was introduced in three steps. First, you have a manifold, and we said what structure you have available to you when you only have a manifold. Then we introduced a connection on that manifold, or in other words, a covariant derivative on that manifold, and a connection on the tangent bundle. And we had some additional structure. We had parallel transport, curvature, geodesics. And then we finally introduced a metric, and suddenly we had a notion of distance on the manifold. If we had a curve, we could tell how long it was. We had a new but equivalent definition of geodesics, new types of curvature we could form. Okay, and then lecture two, the idea was to develop in parallel, was to see that the Yang-Mills gauge field means nothing geometrically, is precisely the connection on the gauge bundle in exactly the same way, almost exactly the same way as the Christoffel, as the connection, as the Christoffel symbol is the connection on the tangent bundle, and just as we are led to introduce the Ricci curvature, which measures the curvature of this connection, the curvature of this connection is nothing but the Yang-Mills field strength. And then we said, what is the simplest? We then wanted to say, what is the simplest action we can write down? It has to be invariant under coordinate transformations in this case, and under coordinate transformations and gauge transformations in this case. And there we saw things diverge. Up to then, everything was parallel, but at that point, we were able to form a completely scalar object that was linear in the curvature, the Ricci scalar, and that thing could serve as the basic object in the action for general relativity. In this case, we weren't able to do that. We had to introduce something that was the square of the curvature of the Yang-Mills field strength, and that was the Yang-Mills action. Okay, then lecture three. We basically just said a little bit more about general relativity. We took the action for general relativity, varied it, and by varying it, we met the Einstein equations and the Einstein tensor and the stress energy tensor, and we saw how the stress energy tensor could be computed by varying the action or the matter part of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric. Actually, this is wrong. But anyway, the formula here is backwards. But so there, anyway, there's two terms that both are built from the matter Lagrangian. And we worked out all of these things for the example of a scalar field, as the sort of simplest example of what the matter part of the action is. And then the final lecture of last week, you know, we saw that despite the fact that these equations, the Einstein equations, are horrible nonlinear partial differential equations for the basic variable g mu nu, nevertheless, for the most important physical systems and situations, it so happens that people have been able to find what the solutions look like. And there's really three categories that are most important. There are the maximally symmetric solutions, which in some sense are the vacuum solutions of general relativity. They are the solutions of this equation when you set t mu nu equal to 0, but allow for the possibility that lambda could be positive, negative, or 0. So those were the spaces that we got were the n-sphere, the n-dimensional Euclidean plane, and the n-dimensional hyperbolic plane, the negatively curved thing. And the corresponding space-times were De Sitter space, Minkowski space, and anti-De Sitter space. And you know, the most important thing to say about this was first we showed that all of these spaces and the ones of arbitrary signature, you know, including two time-like dimensions and so forth, can all be constructed from a single simple construction where you a certain embedding construction in a flat space of one dimension higher, which is very helpful in terms of visualizing the geometry of these spaces. And also leads to a common metric for all of these spaces, that where the metric only differs from one space to another by, you know, signs here and there. And then finally, the most important concrete thing that we calculated, or that I sketched the calculation of, and you're supposed to do the calculation on your first homework assignment, is this formula, the one sort of concrete formula to really take away and remember for the rest of your life about these maximally symmetric spaces, is this guy. This thing is really extraordinarily useful. And every other useful fact about these spaces can be most quickly derived from that guy. OK, and then we said the FRW spacetimes are spacetimes where a given spatial three-dimensional, each spatial three-dimensional slice of the spacetime is a maximally symmetric space. It's the three-dimensional version of one of these. But that space can then evolve in time in an arbitrary way. So whereas the maximally symmetric space had, let's talk about a space-time of 3 plus 1 dimensions, the one we live in 3 plus 1 large space-time dimensions. So, you know, we have 10 symmetries. That's space-time, when I say it has maximally symmetric, it has 10 symmetries. Intuitively, you can think about the symmetries of Minkowski space. You can translate to any new point in the spatial direction, three spatial translations. You translate to any new point in the spatial direction, and it looks like the same space-time. You have one time translation. You can translate to any new point in time, and the space-time looks exactly the same. You have three rotations, so you can rotate about any of three orthogonal axes, and the space-time looks the same, and then you have three boosts. Okay, where by comparison, the FRW space-times, you no longer have time translations. The space-time can stretch and squeeze in an arbitrary way as a function of time. So if you translate to a new point in time, it's different. And you can no longer boost. There's a special frame. There's a special rest frame in which, if I say at that moment in time, I look at the spatial slice, it looks maximally symmetric. If another person flew by at an arbitrary velocity, boosted with respect to me, and sliced his or her space-time, it would not look maximally symmetric on his or her spatial slice. So there's a preferred frame. So we don't have these guys. So we just have these remaining six symmetries. you can translate anywhere in the spatial direction in this preferred reference frame, and you can rotate. You know, the space is isotropic. Any direction you orient your coordinates in, the space looks the same. Whereas, then there's the black hole metrics. The black hole metrics are the ones we have met in least detail and will meet in least detail. But you know, the idea there is that they also have reduced symmetry, but the reduced symmetries are different. For the Schwarzschild metric, which is the unspinning black hole, you still have these three rotations, but you don't have these three boosts. There's a unique frame in which the black hole appears to be at rest. You do have this time translation, but you don't have these three space-time translations. There's a preferred point in space where the black hole is actually located. Okay, so the symmetries that you have left in the non-spinning black hole are these guys, and then in the spinning black hole case, you actually only have one of these. In the Kerr metric, as opposed to the Schwarzschild metric, you really only are left with two symmetries. One, it's a stationary metric. It's somehow space-time in equilibrium. It's the same at later times if you translate forward in time, and then it's the same if you rotate your coordinates around the spin vector, but if you try to do any other rotation, it doesn't stay the same. The direction of the spin of the black hole appears to move. Okay. And so then I left. If you wanted to meet in more quantitative detail the two black hole space times, which I highly recommend, I left that. There's a bit about that in the notes, but we're really not going to cover that in the lecture. And then the final thing we said, you know, this was the one takeaway formula from the maximally symmetric space times. From the FRW space times, we said their metric looks like this. Okay, where this is the so now from now on, so far everything last week I was working in an arbitrary number of dimensions because it didn't make life any harder to do so. But okay, now we're gradually zooming in on reality and cosmology for the most part, except possibly in the very early universe. Well, maybe that's a little bit too strong, but it appears to a very good approximation that our universe on large scales has three spatial dimensions and one time dimension. So we are going to we're going to focus on that. So the FRW metric again looks like a spatial part, which is the maximally symmetric space. So three spatial dimensions, no time dimensions, arbitrary curvature. So the curvature can be positive, negative, or zero. But then there's this scale factor, A of t, which allows this space to stretch and shrink as a function of time, and then a time direction, a time-like direction. And what we said is that the Einstein equations for this space reduce to two different equations, the so-called continuity equation. So the two takeaway points from the previous lecture for the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metrics, are the two basic equations governing an FRW spacetime, the Friedman equation and the continuity equation. Where here rho is the energy density, p is the pressure, k again is the spatial curvature along the spatial slices, lambda is the cosmological constant, h is the so-called Hubble expansion rate, it's dA dt divided by a, so it measures at a given moment, the value of h tells you how fast the universe, the scale factor, is expanding at that moment. And little n is the number of spatial dimensions. So you notice I had to look this thing up. The version of this I actually remember is the three-dimensional version. And that I recommend remembering. Okay, so this is the Friedmann equation. This guy is called the continuity equation. And again, the interpretation is that they complement each other in the following sense. This equation, roughly speaking, says, okay, forget about these terms for a minute. This equation says the more matter that I put in the space-time, the more energy density I put in the space-time, the faster the space-time expands, the bigger h is. And this equation says that, okay, forget about p for a minute. This equation says that the faster that the space-time expands, in other words, the bigger h is, the faster the energy density dilutes. In other words, the more negative rho dot is. Okay. Okay. So that more or less summarizes what we did last week. Yeah.
Like, how would we make this frame in which the spatial part looks maximally symmetric? How would we charge some observer to have this very fair frame?
Yeah. There's some things I have to skip over, but so I was not going to introduce in this class the idea of killing vectors. I don't know if those were introduced in any of the other GR courses, but so that's a formal way of determining what the symmetries of the space-time are and where they what they are like. So the FRW space-time, when I say it has six symmetries, I really mean that the space-time has six killing vector fields that live on it, three of which obey the algebra of spatial translations. And so in principle, you would find the preferred frame by solving Killing's equation for those killing vectors and then choosing the time coordinate to be perpendicular to those three spatial killing vectors. I mean, that would be the formal way to say it. So maybe the only thing I want to say here is there is a formal procedure for doing it. You know, at this level, what I want to say is that there is a coordinate system in which you would find that if you moved around at a given moment in time, and then restarted the evolution of the universe, you just slid around on that space at one moment in time, and then let time start evolving again, you would have no way to tell you had slid anywhere on the space-time. Everything would look, so if you looked out at the night sky over here and you saw that you were surrounded by, for example, a cosmic microwave background of a certain temperature and it was uniform in every direction on the sky, and then you froze time, you moved anywhere else along that spatial slice, and started things going again, the CMB would look exactly the same around that new position, and everything from there forward would evolve the same way. And meanwhile, you would know. I mean, yeah. Well, and if you're in another, if you set up the wrong coordinates, physically, you will know because you will do that same. You would if you did that same imaginary thought experiment. If you froze time and then got on a rocket that was able to travel infinitely fast and without time moving forward, just shoot you over to a different point in the space-time. According to according to the incorrect set of coordinates, so you go, time is frozen. You move along your spatial slice. When you get to that new point, things will look different. For example, there will be more galaxies visible to you on the sky at that moment, at the new spatial point than there were at the old spatial point, or the cosmic microwave background will have a different temperature. Or these are all things that I have to say that I apologize because I will be maybe talking more about these later. So I realize I haven't said anything so far about galaxies or the cosmic microwave background. So in a way, this explanation is it's probably not a good explanation. yeah. Yes.
If we don't have time translation, then it means we don't have conservation of energy.
So the space-time doesn't have time translation, and so a particle moving in that space-time. So for example, a photon moving along, because the space-time is evolving in time, its energy won't be conserved. That's true. Well, there's always this funny thing in gravity about what when you say the total energy, do you mean the total energy of the whole system, including the gravitational energy, or excluding the gravitational energy? But if you talk about the matter energy, it does change with time, or it can change with the total matter energy can change with time, although there can be circumstances where the total matter energy does not change with time, which we'll actually see both systems of both sorts. But in general, you're right that because that it's basically the fact that there's not a time-like killing vector that allows the matter to not have a conserved energy in time. That's true. Okay. So let's see. This class, I want to, in a way, it's all been geometry so far, and now we'd like to get going with a little bit of physical cosmology. And by way of just a starting comment, I would like to say that, somehow, I like the stuff that we're about to do because it's a great example of the sort of thing that you can find in cosmology. There are things that extremely simple observations, very elementary observations, that if you just step back and think, you know, that's an observation I just made about the universe, it's very far-reaching. Somehow, I guess, in all, why am I doing that? If possible, as much as possible for the rest of the class, the idea is to see how many times, how over and over again, you know, maybe the most important things that have been observed about cosmology have been observations that, from an algebraic standpoint, are extremely simple. So somehow you'll find this. This is true throughout the world and certainly throughout academia. People love to get wrapped up in extremely complicated algebra and extremely difficult calculations. Anyway, these are cooler. These are cooler. That's the main thing I want to say. But before we get to the first such observation, I have to say a few preliminary things, because we had introduced all of these maximally symmetric metrics in these quasi-Cartesian coordinates because it gave this nice way to get all the different metrics at once. But in practice, you're not going to, in a cosmology textbook, encounter the FRW metric written in these with the spatial part in these quasi-Cartesian coordinates. So let's just say a few words about the metrics that we actually will encounter and will use for the rest of the class. Okay, so in the quasi-Cartesian coordinates, we said the metric looks like this. Okay, where at the moment, what this is saying is we have a fixed three-dimensional space of fixed radius of curvature rho. So it's always easiest when we're making a picture, you know, imagining a picture in our mind, to imagine the case k equals plus 1, where we're talking about the three-dimensional surface as a three-dimensional sphere, which of course I'll draw as a two-dimensional sphere. So at the moment we have a fixed three-dimensional sphere of radius of curvature rho, and then that thing is being shrunk or stretched by this scale factor a of t. So the first thing we want to do is notice that without loss of generality we can rescale our coordinates so that rho is equal to 1. So that's the standard thing that people do. So to do that, let's introduce new coordinates. So replace each of the x's by rho times x twiddle. So that will make okay, so this will become rho squared x twiddle, this will be rho squared minus k rho squared x twiddle squared. The rho squareds from the numerator and denominator will cancel here. Okay, so this becomes x twiddle I, x twiddle j, 1 minus k x twiddle squared. And then this becomes rho squared dx twiddle dx twiddle. Okay, so then you see that if I define a twiddle, if I define a rho to be a twiddle, then I can absorb this rho squared over here. Okay, so we now have a metric that looks exactly like the original metric, except with a replaced by a twiddle and x replaced by x twiddle, and rho set to 1. Okay, and so I'm just going to drop the twiddles. I'm just going to, from now on, this is the way you'll actually encounter, In a cosmology textbook, this is by convention always done. You always work in coordinates where, if the spatial curvature is non-zero, you have taken the spatial, these spatial coordinates to be rescaled so that the radius of the intrinsic three sphere that you're working with is unity, and then all of the physical stretching and squeezing of the space-time is put into the scale factor. Okay. So from now on, I'm just going to work with this metric where rho is equal to 1. Okay, so the next thing is that, again, you won't see things written in these quasi-Cartesian coordinates. You'll usually see them in some sort of three-dimensional version of spherical coordinates. So we have x1, x2, x3. So first, suppose we introduce spherical coordinates in the usual way. X1 is equal to r sine theta cosine phi. X2 is equal to r sine theta sine phi. And x3 is equal to r cosine theta. Okay, in other words, normal spherical polar coordinates. And you plug that into this metric, then it becomes the first form that you will commonly see. So where this is usually called, this combination d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared is usually called d omega 3 squared, or just d omega squared. I mean, sorry, d omega 2 squared. In other words, this is the metric on the unit. This is the canonical metric on the unit two-dimensional sphere, on the two-dimensional sphere of unit radius. The Minkowski metric in polar coordinates, in spherical coordinates, would be nothing but if you set A is equal to 1 here, and took this to be the ordinary radius and angular coordinates about some origin, it would be minus dt squared plus dr squared plus r squared times this metric. And so the only modifications here are we have an a squared in front of the whole spatial part, and a 1 minus k over kr squared in the denominator to take account of the fact that the spatial sections might be curved. But there's another common radius to use that is in a lot of ways more convenient, and that is, so let's just change the radial coordinate to the other. This r introduced in this way is one of the canonical choices, but there's another one, which is we set r is equal to s sub k of chi, where s sub k of chi, that means sine of chi when k is equal to plus 1, so for a positively curved space, chi when k is equal to minus 1, and sinh chi when k is equal to 0, and sinh chi when k is equal to minus 1. And so when you do that, then this metric becomes this first term. You can check that if you make that substitution, this first term just becomes d chi squared, regardless of whether k is equal to plus 1, minus 1, or 0. And then the second term, well, r is equal to s sub k of chi. So the only thing that changes is that the second term now looks like s sub k squared of chi times the same angular part here, d omega squared. Okay? So we have these two different radial coordinates that you'll see them both used, and you have to be careful to make sure you keep in mind that they mean different things. So geometrically, if this is our three-dimensional sphere, okay, which again I have to draw as a two-dimensional sphere, so the idea is we're confined to the surface of this thing, which I've drawn as a two-dimensional surface, but it's really a three-dimensional surface. So what do these two radiuses mean? If I take a point on that sphere, r is this thing. So I had used these quasi-Cartesian coordinates, which are essentially the coordinates in the equatorial plane. And each of those coordinates labels the point on the sphere directly above it. And the total distance in the equatorial plane between that point and the origin, that's how we defined little r here. Whereas chi is nothing but the distance actually along the surface. So if I just travel radially outward from here from the origin out to the point in question, that's chi. So in other words, as I take this point down here, as I take this point like this, r goes from 0 to 1, but chi goes from 0 to pi over 2. Okay? Is that clear, the two different meanings? Okay, yeah, sorry. So, that's a good point. So often So this is confusing because I should have said this. Often you draw time on the vertical axis and space on the horizontal axis for a space-time diagram. But that's a space-time diagram. This is the embedding diagram for the sphere. So remember that the idea is that this is a three-dimensional sphere, but we constructed it by embedding it in a four-dimensional flat space. So the coordinates in the plane here, in other words, this direction and this direction, I've only been able to show two of them, but they're supposed to be three. X1, X2, X3 are supposed to be directions in the plane in the equatorial plane here. And then this direction is x4, the embedding direction that I eliminated, the fourth direction, the n plus one direction that I solved for and eliminated when I was constructing the maximally symmetric spaces. So this is a fictional fourth spatial dimension that only exists in the embedding space. Okay, so there are those two different radial coordinates, and then the one other thing to say is that there are two different time coordinates that you'll encounter. Maybe I'll. So with this time coordinate, a squared only multiplies the whole spatial part of the metric, here or here. But it's often convenient to make a change of coordinates. Dt is equal to the scale factor times d eta. And so this is called, this is sometimes called cosmic time or proper time or the proper time of a co-moving observer. It's the, well, we'll see in a minute what a co-moving observer is. But in any case, this coordinate, d eta, is also sometimes called d tau, is called conformal time. So the idea, the reason it's called that is that if we make that change of coordinates, so we change each of these dt's into a times d eta, then the a squared appears in front of the whole metric. So now the metric looks like okay, so unfortunately there are these four different possibilities, and you'll encounter all of them. But so there's, in other words, there's two different time coordinates you have to be used to encountering, t and eta. So when t is the coordinate, the scale factor a will be interpreted as only expanding and contracting the spatial part of the metric. When you're working with eta, the scale factor expands and contracts the whole spacetime, basically. Or the time direction as well, I should say, all four directions in the spacetime. And then there are these two different radial coordinates, r and chi, which have these two different, which in the case of the sphere have these two. In the case of the flat plane, they're the same. But in the case of the positively curved spatial slices, they have these two different meanings in terms of how they measure the radial distance from the origin to a point. It's harder to draw, but similarly there's some similar, schematically speaking, the negatively curved spacetime wants to curve away, and again there's r and there's a notion of chi, which now goes off to infinity as r goes off to infinity. The space doesn't close up here. It goes off to infinity. Okay, so those are the coordinates on an FRW spacetime. Let me see, is there anything else I want to say about that? No. Okay, so, oh yes, one thing. So ddt is conventionally written as a dot in cosmology. So dadt is conventionally written as a dot. Dd eta, dd conformal time, is conventionally written with a prime. So d eta is written as a prime. Okay, and that's it. That's all the notational stuff. So now I just want to end by describing the There's two things we want to get to know now about these spacetimes, which can, roughly speaking, be described as their kinematics and dynamics, where, okay, I'm probably only going to have time to discuss the kinematics in the remainder of this lecture, but so, in other words, the two things you really want to understand are how do test particles behave as they move through the spacetime? So massive and massless test particles move along geodesics of this spacetime. What do they do? What happens to them as a result of the expansion of the universe? And this also, so test particle geodesics. And then this also leads to the notion of the, this also will let us understand what the horizons are like in the space-time. And then the dynamics, this is more, if you put matter in the space-time, how does it evolve? And so we want to sort of know, well, anyway, so the dynamics, which is probably going to end up being pushed to the beginning of the next lecture, has to do with what the actual solutions for the space-time look like, depending on what sort of matter I put into them and what sort of initial conditions I give them. Okay, so let's talk about the geodesics. Somehow these erasers are extremely effective, but not very satisfying to use. They feel like a little too, you know, you don't have to lean into them or anything. They feel like you're ice skating with them or something. I feel like they were devised with just the students in mind, and like, but what about the lecturer, you know? There are certain pleasures that I get out of the lecturing process that I feel are not being taken into consideration. Okay. Okay. So the main thing that I want to get across is so what we want to derive is that for both the most important thing to remember, the thing that will give you everything else, is that the magnitude of the spatial momentum of a particle moving through a Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime redshifts as 1 over a. So as the spacetime expands, as a increases, the magnitude of the spatial momentum decreases. For massive particles, that means that they're going to come to rest with respect to the so-called co-moving observers, the preferred observers in that spacetime. And for massless particles, it means that, did I just say mass? For massive particles, they're going to come to rest with respect to the co-moving observers. Massless particles, like photons, they are not going to come to rest. They're always going to be moving. They'll always move by the co-moving observers at the speed of light, but their frequency will be redshifted. Their frequency will get lower and lower in proportion to A as the universe expands. Okay, so let's just see why this is true. So remember that if I have some curve through a spacetime, this is some particle is moving through the spacetime with coordinates x mu as a function of its proper time d tau. The tangent vector to this spacetime, u mu dx mu d tau. Well, the idea is that in general relativity, So first of all, the tangent vector is the so-called four velocity of that particle. And for a massive particle, its momentum, p mu, is its mass times its four velocity. And so it's convenient to define a new parameter along the curve, which is a new parameter d lambda, which is just proportional to the proper time with a proportionality constant m, so that this becomes dx mu d lambda. The advantage of this notation is just that it still makes sense even when the mass goes to zero. Okay, so the idea in general relativity is that particles, test particles, move along special curves through the metric, namely the geodesics, along which their four velocity, the tangent vector, or their momentum is parallel transported. So again, the geodesic equation, the statement that the momentum are parallel transported along the direction of the vector, is that if I take the directional derivative along the direction of the tangent vector, of the tangent vector itself, that thing vanishes. Okay? So if I expand this, it says that dx mu d lambda, and then I expand this guy, d mu p nu plus gamma nu mu alpha p alpha. So this first term, I can use the chain rule. So partial p nu with respect to x mu times contracted with dx mu d lambda, that's nothing but the chain rule expansion of this. And then the second term here, let me call this p mu again for the sake of the second term. So the second term is okay. So let's look at the nu equals zero component of this equation. So dp zero d lambda, the first term. Let me rewrite that as dp zero as dt d lambda dp zero dt. In other words, I just multiplied and divided by dt. And then the second term, so you may or may not have had a chance to do this, but one of the things that is in the notes from the previous lecture and which you check on the homework is that most of the Christoffel symbols vanish. The only Christoffel symbols that don't vanish in an FRW spacetime are the ones that have either two or three spatial indices. So in particular, if we're taking the nu equals zero component here, both of these have to be spatial indices. And furthermore, the thing you check is that gamma zero ij is just the Hubble expansion rate times gij, the spatial metric, the spatial part of the metric. So this thing is hgij. Okay, and so this gij contracted with pipj, that is just the spatial magnitude. That is the magnitude of the spatial part of the particle's momentum. Okay, so let's call that capital P squared. P is the magnitude of the spatial momentum. So g includes a squared.
Oh.
G is here. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So good point. So gij in our notation is a squared times gij, what we were calling before, 3 comma 0 k. Okay, so this thing is equal to 0. And one final thing I want to do is, so dt d lambda, that's just the mu equals 0 component of this expression. So that's just p0. So this is really p0. P0 d lambda. And then for a particle of mass m squared, its mass is the square of its four momentum. So in gr, the mass of a particle is nothing but its four momentum dotted with itself in the metric. But for an FRW metric, this is nothing but minus p0 squared plus what we just called capital P squared. And this is a constant associated with the particle. The idea is a particle has some constant mass that's intrinsic to it. So if we take the differential of this expression, we get minus 2 p0, we get 0 is equal to minus 2 p0 dp0 plus 2 capital P d capital P. In other words, p0 dp0 is equal to capital P d capital P. Okay, so I'll use this to rewrite this. Whoops, I made an algebra error. Right, that this is just this. Okay, so this is capital P dt. And then I'll move this over to the other side of the expression just for convenience. So is equal to minus h p squared. Okay, so let me divide by p squared on both sides. This p becomes a 1 over p. And this p goes away. This is looking kind of messy. So 1 over p dp dt is equal to minus h. Now h is just 1 over a dA dt. So let me just multiply both sides by dt. So this really just says dp over p is equal to minus dA over a. And so you may or may not recognize that this basically says that p is proportional to 1 over a. But I mean, just explicitly, dp over p is nothing but d of log p. Right? Probably can't see this. So dp over, our equation is dp over p is equal to minus dA over a. But that's just d of log p is equal to minus d of log a. So integrating both sides from p0 to p and a0 to a, this says log of p over p0 is equal to minus log of a over a0, which says p is, so exponentiating both sides, this just says p is proportional to 1 over a. If this is our spatial three sphere, if this is our spatial surface, if a massive particle's spatial momentum is going to zero as the universe expands, if it's decaying as one over a, that's saying it's coming to rest. It's coming to rest with respect to the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker coordinates. So as this sphere expands, and I initially fire some massive particle in this direction, it climbs. But at a later time, the sphere has expanded a little bit, and it's moving more slowly. At a later time, more slowly. It eventually ends up asymptoting to move along with some, if I just drew a dot on the balloon, a co-moving observer is, it's easiest to visualize in this case where the three sphere is just stretching as a function of time. You know, it's like the universe expanding is like blowing up the balloon, and if I just drew a dot on the balloon with a marker and just followed the trajectory of that dot as a function of time, doesn't move along the balloon, it just rides along at a fixed point on the balloon. That's a so-called co-moving observer. So this equation for a massive particle says that it, you know, because once its momentum gets small enough, it's non-relativistic. Its momentum is just m times its speed. This is basically just saying that its speed relative to the coordinate system we set up. The co-moving coordinates, the spatial coordinates that we set up, that by definition ride along with the sphere because they are just coordinates on the sphere. So the velocity, the speed is just decaying away. The massive particle is just becoming asymptoting to one of these co-moving observers. On the other hand, for a photon, again, we have that equation m squared is equal to minus p0 squared plus capital P squared at the top of the board. So minus pz, so for a photon, m squared is 0, and p0 is its energy. So p squared, capital P is just equal to the energy of a photon. So this says that the energy of a photon is going down as 1 over a as the universe expands. So you know, if I fire a photon, then as the universe expands, whenever that photon happens to make it past a given co-moving observer who's sitting at this point on the balloon, that observer will say, you know, wow, that photon's going by at the speed of light. But that's very impressive. But that's impressively fast. Each successive co-moving observer will be less impressed by the energy of that photon. The photon's frequency, or its energy, h bar times its frequency, will be seen as, you know, if it passes by co-moving observer 1 when the universe has a linear size a1, and then it passes by co-moving observer 2 over here when the universe has a bigger size a2, co-moving observer 2 will measure its energy to be smaller than co-moving observer 1 did by a factor of a1 over a2, by a factor equal to the amount that the universe has expanded. So let's see. I will just take a minute or two to say, to finish up the kinematics story, just to explain why and in what sense Friedman, Roberts, and Walker universes have horizons. Okay, so for simplicity, let's imagine that the universe was expanding as a power law in time. Okay, so the scale factor is increasing with time as t over some constant t naught to a power p, where p is some number, so it's expanding. We want p to be greater than 0, and it expands from, so the universe will expand from zero size, from a equals 0, up to infinite size, a equals infinity, as t runs from 0 to infinity. So let's convert this into its expression in terms of conformal time. So remember that conformal time is related to we had written it as dt is equal to a d eta, but so I'll just divide by a on both sides. So in other words, so this is proportional to, for this metric, this is proportional to dt over t to the p. So in other words, when I integrate, I will find that eta scales like t to the 1 minus p, or in other words, t goes like eta to the 1 over 1 minus p. So when I make this substitution in here, I will find that in terms of conformal time, a scales like eta to the p over 1 minus p. Okay, where the p comes from here, and the 1 over 1 minus p comes from here. So, but now, notice that here, this exponent can be either positive or negative. This exponent is positive when p is between 0 and 1, but a negative when p is between 1 and infinity. So as a result, we had this scale factor that as t ran from 0 to infinity, A expanded from 0 to infinity. So here, we're just describing the same expansion from 0 to infinity of the scale factor A, but in different coordinates. And so to get, when this numerator is positive, to get the scale factor to go from 0 to infinity, we again, you can see that we're going to end up having to have eta run from 0 to infinity. But when this thing is negative, if we want the scale factor to run from 0 to infinity, as eta moves forward, eta has to run from minus infinity to 0. Okay, and this will just, if you just follow through the change of coordinates between d eta and dt, you'll be led to this result that when p is in this range, eta will run between a finite value and positive infinity. When p is in this range, it'll run between negative infinity and a finite value. And so the advantage of having converted things into written things in terms of eta is that now it's very easy in terms of eta to see what will happen to a light ray that we emit or a photon that we absorb at time eta star, at some finite time eta star. Okay, because a light ray, so suppose I'm sitting here at the origin, chi equals 0. And at some time eta star, I send out a photon. Okay, I send out a photon and I ask, how far will it get? Well, a photon moves along a trajectory with ds squared is equal to 0. And in the eta chi coordinates, if I'm sitting at the origin and I send a photon radially outward, d omega is 0. It moves out along a constant direction. It moves radially outward, so the angular coordinates of it don't change. So ignore this. So for ds squared to be equal to 0, that's just saying d chi squared has to be equal to d eta squared. I'm making a mess of this. So this implies d chi squared is equal to d eta squared. So when I take the square root, d chi is equal to plus or minus d eta. But here it's clear which sign I should take. If I send the photon out at time eta star, as eta increases, it should move radially outward. Chi should also increase. So I want the plus sign. So I integrate this thing and get that chi as a function of eta is equal to eta minus eta star. And now I just observe about this solution that as I let the universe expand to infinite size now, in the case that zero is between p, in the case that p is between 0 and 1, eta will increase to infinity in this expression. So the photon will reach chi equals infinity. The photon will manage to travel an arbitrarily long way. I'm going to confuse you about this. Okay, let's forget my sphere for a minute. Drat. I've just confused you right at the end of the lecture, and now I'm not going to be able to clean up the mess before next lecture. Okay. So I should have said that you can run into a problem with closed universes that are spatial three spheres, that they will recollapse and time will only extend up to a finite value. So implicitly, I should have said, for simplicity, let's consider a universe that expands as a simple power law and is spatially flat. So it will just continue doing so forever. But then I kept drawing this sphere over here, so I apologize for that. So forget the sphere. But still, so you're on some plane, and this three-dimensional plane is expanding as the universe expands. And the question is, how far out will the light signal get? Well, when p is in this range, eta goes to infinity, so it will reach chi equals infinity. It will go arbitrarily far out. It will reach an arbitrarily large co-moving coordinate. But in this range, it won't. The largest value eta will ever reach is zero, and so in that case, the light ray will only reach eta equals minus chi is equal to minus eta star. It'll reach this terminal value. It'll only ever make it out to a finite value of chi. So we say about that that the particle has a future horizon, that the observer at this moment in time has a future horizon. There's some finite distance to which he can send signals before the end of the universe. Then there's some region of the space-time to which he can never send a signal. So it's very analogous to being inside a black hole. So this p in this range, you can check, corresponds to a decelerating universe, a universe which has a double dot whose second derivative is negative. So a decelerating universe, the observer can send a signal that will reach arbitrarily far away in co-moving coordinates. But in an accelerating universe, you can only send a signal out to a finite distance in co-moving coordinates. It's very analogous to living inside a black hole. And then I'll just explain this right at the beginning of the next lecture. If you look to the past and ask what do the past horizons look like, it's the opposite. If you live in an accelerating space-time, there's no. If you receive a photon at a given moment in time, it can have come from arbitrarily far away in the past. But in a decelerating universe, that's not true. When you receive a photon, it can only have come from within a finite sphere of co-moving radius. So you have a past horizon. So it's very analogous to living. There's regions of space-time from which you can never have received signals. So that's very analogous to living outside a black hole. So you're used to, in a black hole, there being this event horizon that has two meanings. If you live outside the black hole, there's a region you can't receive signals from, and if you live inside the black hole, there's a region you can't send signals to, but the surface separating those two regions is the same. And in cosmology, they're separated into these two different notions of horizon, the future horizon and the past horizon. Sorry for running over. I'll try not to do that in the future. But I was at risk of making a complete mess of it, and then 30 years hence, you'll never remember what I say at the beginning of next lecture. You'll only remember the wrong information I gave you at the end of this one. So.